This is Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 68 of Speaking of Mysteries. Our guest is Matthew Gwynn, whose debut novel, The Resurrectionist, was nominated in 2014 for an Edgar Award. His second crime fiction novel, The Scribe, is set against the 1881 International Cotton Exhibition in Atlanta, Georgia, the cusp of what Atlanta's power elite hoped would be the birth of the New South. The story teams up disgraced Atlanta police detective Thomas Canby and Atlanta's only black police detective, Cyrus Underwood, to investigate a series of brutal murders among Atlanta's affluent black community. The investigation turns into an odyssey that takes all involved through a complicated maze of clashing expectations. Here's Matthew Gwynn. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and our episode today is with Matthew Gwynn, whose The Scribe, his second mystery, is to be released on September 15th, 2015. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you. Good to be here.
At its core, The Scribe's story is a hunt for a brutal serial killer. But it's the backdrop, which is the International Cotton Exhibition in 1881 in Atlanta, which informs the setting. Why did you choose that time and place for your second novel?
I think for me, the International Cotton Exhibition was what really did take place historically, and the parts that I imagined was just this clash of the old South and the new. And the more I study the South and Southern history, the more I think that's the key to our identity. And Atlanta really embodies that new South ethos of progress and technology and social mobility and so forth. And in my years living in other parts of the South, the deep South, you can see a lot more of that plantation culture surviving in an attenuated format, but still that sense of social order and ranking and so forth. And I just thought it would be a really new, interesting vision of a killer for the villain in this book to be somebody who represents a portion of that old order who's not at all fond of quote-unquote progress.
It's interesting that you bring that up. If the past is a foreign country, I think for many that makes the American South of the past doubly so. And I was wondering, how difficult was it to write about post-Civil War and post-Reconstruction Atlanta in a way that would be approachable not just to other regions of the United States, but the world?
Well, that's a good question, and one that I cringe a little bit when somebody says historical novelist, because there are a good many historical novels that do not interest me at all. To me, the cutoff point where I know I need to revise or pick up the pace or maybe put a little less detail in is you never want your reader to feel like they're sitting in history class. So you can use the past, and so much of the past is so interesting. For example, as Americans, we used to be so much more physically tough than we are today. Those soldiers who fought in the Civil War wore wool uniforms. And I don't know how much time you spent in the South, but most of that war was fought down here. And good gracious, a wool uniform in Mississippi in August is a special kind of torture. But to them, it was daily life. But yeah, I don't ever want it to seem like focusing on minutia. As long as that past is interesting and as long as it speaks to the present and we can see something of ourselves in it, then it's good and usable and not pedantic. But when it does get, I try to keep the slow out of it.
Well, you actually touched on that in the afterword to the book. You likened writing historical fiction, which I'm going to put air quotes around, to a walk across a tightrope, with the story being the taut line on which you're balancing and the ground being spiked with potential errors and fact on which you might impale yourself, and with it, the story. So your first mystery, which was the wonderful The Resurrectionist, was also a mystery that had significant portions that took place in the past. But, you know, what draws you then, considering you don't want something to be historical and pedantic and boring, what draws you to set your stories in the past?
Yeah, a lot of it is purely selfish, just trying to figure out who I am in my cultural moment and time, which is the South, and which I love, in spite of its many, many flaws and ugly realities. I think for the resurrectionist, where I turned a corner with that, I hope, is when I went from thinking about the character of Nemo Johnson as why would he do that to his own people, to, as one of my African-American characters said, almost a gift from above to me, what makes you think he had a choice? And for me, the interesting thing about the character of Nemo was, just based on the little bit that's known about the real resurrectionist, Grandison Harris, is why would any of us have chosen to follow his path, given the very, very limited amount of options he had? And so for me, empathy is what I always come back to about whether it's worth my time in writing and my reader's time in reading, is what can we learn from walking in someone else's shoes a century before that very different day-to-day existence than we have. And also, Shelby Foote, I read his Civil War trilogy. It took most of a year for me to read it, but he says you can't understand contemporary America without understanding the Civil War. And whether that's still true or not, I think it is, but you can't understand the South without understanding the Civil War. Reading his, I've never been much of a Civil War buff, but reading Shelby Foote's history, I realized just about everywhere you walk in the South, some part of that war took place here. You're walking on it. And so many of the subterranean themes of the resurrectionists were circling back to that idea that we're walking on history every time we take a step, figuratively and metaphorically, but also a lot of the times literally, with buried bones in that case. In Atlanta's case, just this curious non-remembrance that seems to be the nature of us Atlantans. But the past is all around us, underfoot.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because one of my questions was that, you know, with the people who had lived during the war in your book, in The Scribe, many of them didn't have physical marks on them, but no one survived that war unscarred. And the murderer... Mm-hmm. Is that you, and you mentioned this before, the murderer is clearly unbalanced in a very, very big way. I'm wondering if you think that person might not have been tipped over the edge if it hadn't been for the war. Is one of the wars, were his victims essentially also victims of the Civil War because of what happened?
Well, I hadn't thought of it that way, but yes, they became targets because of the opportunities of post-Reconstruction and Reconstruction to them. What I thought of, I have to be careful talking about this for spoilers, but very early in Toni Morrison's Beloved, Setha, the slave, is looking out on the plantation Sweet Home, and she said she thinks it never looked as terrible as it was. And for that, to me, was just a revelation, because your typical white Southerner looks on the plantation and only sees the house, only sees the prosperity. And I think your enlightened African-American Southerner looks on the plantation and sees exploitation, dehumanization, and a rapacious profit taken out of unpaid labor. And that intrigues me, because in the South we still have so much of that gone with the wind mentality that a lot of white Southerners who are otherwise enlightened and kind simply brush the African-American part of that plantation experience out of their minds. And to me, it was akin to Nazi Germany, as far as it's stunning that we can be nostalgic about it and romanticize something that was really that brutal. And for me, it's been an awakening to seeing it that way. Through a different perspective.
just to shift a little bit, your protagonist, Thomas Canby, was drummed out of the Atlanta police force after the end of Reconstruction. And his downfall was very, very costly to him. And then he's asked to return to save the force that turned its back on him. And I'm curious, what motivated him to help? Was it more personal redemption or the need to save innocent lives? I found him a fascinating character because it was hard to get into his head.
Well, thank you. That's great to hear. I based the scribe, and I'm trying to draw as much again for the next novel, Red Mountain, on Dante's Inferno. And, you know, Dante was exiled on trumped-up charges from Florence, and Inferno opens with him seeing symbolic animals, and one of them symbolizes pride, the mountain lion. And Canby has an encounter very early on with the mountain lion, and without judging him too harshly, I think, well, anybody who is unjustly accused and convicted of something really would fight to reclaim their honor, but particularly for Canby, who's trying to negotiate some metaphysics with the world as a non-believer, as an agnostic, in spite of his father being very religious and raising him in that tradition. Honor and clearing his name is paramount, but the fight to clear his name is going to be dangerous, hopefully as symbolized with that mountain lion encounter that he has in the first pages of the book. But yes, I think I was really thrilled when I came across one of my epigraphs in researching this book early on, and it's that Jeffrey Burton Russell epigraph, "The more intense is one's love for the planet and its creatures, the more intense is one's agony over the evil that twists it." And I thought, if that's not Thomas Canby, I don't have my head around this character. And I think that that's a part of his motivation, too. If he's uncertain about God, the universe, the hereafter, at least he has a belief in justice and the possibility of justice being attainable in the here and now.
Well, he's also interesting in other ways. You know, during the war, he lived in Atlanta, and he survived Sherman's assault, and then he joined the Union Army.
Yes.
Was that something that actually happened? Did people who lived... I mean, that was news to me, especially someone that lived in the Deep South. You know, it's not a border mm-hmm. state. Georgia was not a border state. Would join the Union Army. I mean, did that happen?
Yes, it did. It's fascinating about the whole states' rights argument because it tends to get diluted significantly when you look at parts of the Deep South that were mountainous and thus could not be home to plantations and slave labor. If you look at East Tennessee and North Georgia and North Alabama, there were pockets of pro-Union sentiment. They said, we don't want to secede. This is about slavery. We don't have slaves. We don't want to get caught up in this. And it was in East Tennessee that the phrase originated, that the Civil War was a rich man's war and a poor man's fight. And that's Southerners, Tennesseans, saying that. So there was some of that with Canby. And also one thing that does not get told properly in most of the history books is how much collateral damage William Tecumseh Sherman caused. You can make the argument that he was guilty of crimes of war for the number of civilians that were killed in his sieges and in the way he practiced total warfare before it was such a term. And that affected Thomas Canby. So joining the Union Army would get him closest to Sherman since he felt that he had a score to settle with him for some of those collateral damages during the siege of Atlanta.
And yet, in the book, and we won't discuss why, but Sherman makes an appearance, and he visits Atlanta. Did that really happen? And didn't
that really happen?
And yes.
Atlanta, you've got to wonder how far, and I grew up there, so I don't mean this as just like a condemnation, but you just have to wonder how small the denomination of dollar bill would have to be for an Atlanta not to chase it down the street. And they really did invite Sherman back for the Cotton Exposition. because he was a celebrity, and I think he had published his post-war memoirs at that time, but I still find that hard to believe that somebody who destroyed the city would be invited back. But it did happen, and in fact, his little speech at the exposition is taken word for word from what he actually said when he came back to the exhibition.
I just can't believe that the citizens of Atlanta, who, especially those who were there during the siege and when he burned it to the ground, would go out to meet him and greet him and not try to kill him. Not to right. find a point on it.
I think part of the sentiment with it was this reconciliation, and there were some very, very honorable Confederates. General Longstreet is probably the foremost of them, who, once the war was over, really did bury the hatchet and really did say, well, that didn't work. Now let's work on reintegrating ourselves to the United States. And I guess Henry Grady, the editor of the Constitution and one of the big cheerleaders of the Cotton Exposition, I guess they saw inviting Sherman back as almost like the Southern Baptists would do a foot washing to demonstrate humility. And I think that they saw that as kind of the peak of reconciliation sentiment, to invite Sherman back to Atlanta, such that Grady even made jokes about him being kind of careless with fire in public speeches. So,
well, that was it's interesting to find out that was actually happened, and I could see someone, I could see a magazine editor doing that, you know, making an aside. You know, it may or may not be forgiven, but it certainly isn't forgotten. But still, that is quite a remarkable circumstance, because it's got to still be, it's what, 15 years, 16 years after the end of the war, and the city has been through reconstruction. Much of Atlanta is rebuilt, but scars are still visible everywhere from what happened. Mm-hmm. And they invite the man who was the architect of their destruction to talk at an event that is heralds in their new beginning. It seems like a big disconnect, but also just how really messed up, I can't think of a better term, messed up the whole situation was.
Yes, I mean, the human animal is never going to cease to surprise us, I don't think. And you know, one thing, Nancy, that I found doing these historical novels is I find things that are true in history that I keep waiting for my editor to balk at. You know, that's not believable. That's not believable. And some of the wildest things in these two books that I've written are actual true events. No imagination involved, just reporting what happened.
Well, it's fascinating. You know, it's as they sometimes say, you just can't make this stuff up.
Because,
because if you did, no one would believe it. If it happened, it happened. But if you made it up, it would be unbelievable.
It would be implausible. Yes, implausible.
Well, you mentioned what you're working on next, and Dante is a fabulous inspiration for many, many stories, and you anticipated my question about, we are going to see Thomas Canby again, because he's a fascinating guy.
Awesome. I'm glad to hear that. Yes, we're going to see Cyrus Underwood and Thomas Canby again, headed to Birmingham. The book I'm working on now is working title is Red Mountain, which is the name of the ridge that defines Birmingham. Of course, it has some obvious metaphorical associations as well. But yes, it's fascinating getting into this. One of my great idols as a writer was Larry Brown from Oxford, Mississippi. And I know some academics kind of turn their nose up when he would say, well, I just turn my characters loose and see where they go. And, you know, of course, you've got your PhDs in English saying, well, it's all signifiers, it's ink on the page, et cetera, et cetera, which is probably why so few of them write novels. But I'm fascinated. I thought that was a little far out for Larry to say, but when these characters do assume a life of their own, it's the best part of the process to me. It doesn't happen every day you sit down, of course, but when these characters make a left turn, say, when you expected them to take a right, and then that makes more sense for them than it does in the way you were planning on the story going, that's when I think you're creating a character who is human, who is, as we were saying a moment ago, unpredictable, maybe even implausible in some of their motivations, but closer to real.
Well, I didn't mean to neglect Cyrus Underwood, who is, in his own way, a fascinating character. And I'm wondering, did the city of Atlanta start to include black men? Because, of course, they would never include a woman. Black men into their police force in their post-Reconstruction world?
Not at all. As soon as the Redeemers, and that's a term used in the novel by Henry Grady for the old Southerners who reclaimed power after Reconstruction, when they could turn back the tide of Reconstruction and redeem the South. It's strange how Grady was both progressive and old school. That as soon as they could get every African American out of office or any position of authority, they did so. And the Atlanta police force wasn't integrated until the late 1940s, I found out since then. I thought it would be hopefully plausible in fiction that the chief, Vernon Thompson, my fictional chief of police in Atlanta, would want to bring Underwood on because these murders were racial. I had hoped that my reader would say, well, that does make any kind of sense, even if, you know, such that hopefully it doesn't appear anachronistic. But we see, I guess he would have brought a black man on to help solve these black crimes. And, of course, I wanted it for Canby, who's trying to be fully human after his horrible experiences in the war and his losses and his dishonor that was most undeserved. Him trying to see this black colleague as fully human, as his equal. And that would definitely, especially in the 1880s, for any kind of white Southerner, that would be a long, complex process.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that Canby was agnostic at best and an unbeliever in the extreme, going toe-to-toe with Mr. Underwood with Scripture. That was some of my favorite. Yeah. That was some of my favorite parts of the book, when they were sort of what I call dueling biblical quotes.
That's wonderful.
I'm looking forward. When do you expect Red Mountain, if that is its eventual title, to be published? Have you turned it in?
I have not. I've still got a good bit of it left to write. And hope to get to it by the holidays when we're through most of the tour for the scribe, get back to it pretty close to full time. We've been on, with the Resurrectionist and the Scribe, we've been on a pretty good schedule of publication with Norton. Hardback 1 year, paperback that one the next year, and then hardback again. So I would love to get it out in 2017 if I can get it done in time.
Well, we should let you go so you can get back to writing.
No, not a problem at all. Not a problem at all. It's interesting with the book touring and promotion element. You go from being an introvert almost to the point of being a recluse, working by yourself in a silent room, to the extroverted side of the business. But it keeps it very interesting.
Well,
I love both parts of it.
Where is your book tour going to be taking you?
We're covering the Southeast pretty well and not going much farther than that. But next week we go to New Orleans, and then I spend a week in North Carolina. And we're also hitting the Gulf Coast and Tennessee, Memphis, Nashville, and then Athens. We'll do another event in Atlanta and Athens also in October, I believe.
Well, thank you so much, Matthew, for your time and for talking to us about the scribe and what came before in The Resurrectionist and what hopefully will be coming soon in Red Mountain. I appreciate your time and answering our questions.
Oh, absolutely. It's been a pleasure, Nancy. I appreciate your interest.
In the next few weeks, I'm hoping to interview Rhys Bowen about her latest royal spyness mystery, Malice at the Palace, Joe Clifford about his debut mystery, Lamentation, and John Katzenbach about his latest thriller, The Dead Student. Until next time, this is Nancy Clare. Thank you for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.